This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. The governor steps in to avert a strike, librarians get up in arms about budget cuts, and a baseball battle is brewing between Hartford and New Britain. Those are just a few of the stories we will tackle today on The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Join us as always, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in studio, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, coming off of 3 hours of talking about potholders and our fundraiser. How you doing, Colin?
Well, for a pledge of $50, I'll say good morning, Mr. Dankowski.
Thank you very much, and thanks for being here. Mark Pazniokas is Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. How you doing, Paz?
Happy tax day.
It is tax day, isn't it? We're going to talk about that in a little bit. Dan Haar is columnist for the Hartford Current. Hello there, Dan.
Happy sesquicentennial day, but not so happy.
Not so happy, indeed. Before we get started, one happy thing to just announce. Today is the birthday of Katie Talarski, the executive producer of Where We Live, a person who helped me found the show, and who not so many years ago, Colin, said, you know what you should really do is a weekly news roundtable. You really should do that. And I fought her on this. And once again, she had a great idea.
Right. Well, so the battles we lose sometimes are the battles we win.
But happy birthday, Katie, and thank you for everything, and you're going to have a great day. It is tax day. We're not going to talk about that off the top. Instead, we're going to talk about something kind of weird that happened at the State Judiciary Committee. It didn't finish some of its important work by an important deadline. It was the result, they say, of an email sent by Representative Minnie Gonzalez to Representative Rosa Rabimbus, somebody I've not met personally, in regards to the renomination of Chief Justice Chase Rogers. This is a very long hearing that happened. Gonzalez reportedly said that Rabimbus was cold and with no heart and that, quote, every pig has his Saturday. And that brought the Judiciary Committee to a grinding halt. Here is State Senator John Kissel, he's a Republican, describing what happened there.
Apparently an email that was rather inflammatory was sent out by Representative Gonzalez to a variety of outlets. I'm guessing Friday or Saturday. And because of what was in that email, there was a request by Senate and House leadership that a simple apology, both in writing and verbally, would be appropriate. Nothing elaborate. The written could be via email, just so that Ms. Gonzalez or Representative Gonzalez would apologize to Representative Rabimbus. We waited patiently all day. That never really happened. And so several members of on our side of the aisle felt that this was no longer just about Representative Gonzalez and Representative Rabimbus, but about what's appropriate protocol, especially in a highly respected committee such as within the Judiciary Committee. And so the co-chairs and myself and Representative Rabimbus worked hard, and if somehow an apology was issued anywhere prior to about 4:30, we probably could have gotten 20 to 30 bills out.
Okay, so that's, again, a rather lengthy quote from State Senator John Kissel, but it lays out a bit of what the drama was surrounding this. Colin, I'll give you the floor first. And there's so much to sort of tackle in this weird little event that happened at the Capitol. What do you make of all this?
Well, first of all, you know, if John Kissel had been around 150 years ago, somebody shot the president. That was not appropriate. And
by the way, John's wrong. That was not a long quote by Senator Kissel.
No, we've heard longer quotes than that. Well, I mean, look, this is nobody covered themselves with glory on this particularly. I mean, Minnie Gonzalez is out of control. She is absolutely out of control. And this is just sort of the latest manifestation of it. This crusade she has against Chase Rogers, whom she's making into this kind of artificial target over a whole bunch of other issues, especially family court and guardians ad litem. She wants reform of the system. This is the worst way to get it. I mean, she's acting like an idiot, to tell you the truth. But on the other hand, everybody else could have stepped up too. It seems to me, I don't know what the chairs of the committee said to her, but I mean, if in fact that's what the Republicans wanted, it was pretty appropriate for the two judiciary chairs to say, do it. Do it so we can get going here. Let's get back to work. Enough of your shenanigans. I mean, I don't know if anybody can talk to Minnie Gonzalez, but somebody should be trying to right now, saying enough. You're really getting in the way of doing business. Now, you know, I don't blame the Republicans for being angry about this. On the other hand, shanghaiing a day of work for 20 to 30 bills that really some of them have far-reaching impact. because you're mad at the stupidest, most out of control member of the Democratic side of your committee. I mean, that's not constructive either. And the last thing I'll say is that I'm tired of reading that all of these bills are dead or gone. You know, I mean, just do more work. Okay, you had a really bad day and you got behind on work because one of your members is behaving like a petulant child. But that's no excuse not to get the work done. Get the work done. Some of these bills are really important.
Paz?
Yeah, a couple things. One, I should, in the interest of full disclosure, rather than sitting in the Judiciary Committee meeting Monday, I was at Fenway Park, where I did observe a life lesson that applies to this situation. The Washington Nationals hit at least two Red Sox batters. There were warnings issued, but the Red Sox did not retaliate. They played on.
Yes.
You have that dynamic here. You do have this baseball analysis of one of their teammates was insulted, was offended, Rosa Rabimbus, who's the ranking Republican on Judiciary. So the Republican Party closed ranks and they shut down the Judiciary Committee on a key day. So there's that point. That's what that was about. There was an apology, but it was a half-hearted apology. And really, what is it? These comments were not made openly. These comments were in an email. And the apology wasn't for what was in the email. The apology was for the fact that people saw the email and understood. So that's that. As far as Representative Gonzalez, this email shows the emotion that surrounds her on this issue. The people who are involved in this issue being how family courts are run, how something called guardian ad litems are appointed and what they cost the families who, you know, these are lawyers appointed to represent children in the most contentious of divorce cases. And there's all kinds of issues, one of which is simply cost. I mean, the cost can be astronomical. So there's some real legitimate issues here at the heart of it. But there's also some like crazy, crazy emotion that you have. And there's a lot of suspicion about the judiciary by the people involved in this. And Minnie Gonzalez's email reflected that. Minnie is not a lawyer. You know, it was all the ugliness and all the suspicion. You know, she suggested that Rosa Rabimbus is interested in fees as a lawyer, not interested in protecting families. You know, pretty explosive stuff.
Well, just very quickly to carry your baseball analogy, though, it's sort of not like one team has a player hit and the other team does or doesn't retaliate. It's kind of like the other team just decides to walk off the field and the game's over and 37,000 people file out of Fenway. And that's kind of what Colin's getting at is there is work to be done. There's a finite amount of time to do the work.
Right. And, you know, the other thing that should be noted, the Speaker of the House, Brendan Sharkey, reacted, I think, in a way that most people would consider to be responsible. He was offended by Representative Gonzalez's email. He directed her to apologize. Apparently, it took like 7, 8, 9 drafts, and the ultimate draft that was acceptable to Representative Gonzalez was not acceptable to the Republicans. So, you know, I think, as Colin said, you know, no one's covered in glory here. You know, the Republicans could have viewed Sharkey's involvement as that's really the key thing. The Speaker of the House has said this is wrong, and the representative involved should apologize. You know, the question is, should that have been enough? And that was really where I was going with my Red Sox analogy. You know, the Red Sox just moved on and won the game. The Republicans could have moved on. And by the way, the Republicans could have probably extracted a deal out of this because when you have these moments, that's when the minority can actually get some action that they want on bills. But, you know, it was an opportunity to pass.
I think you made the right choice not sitting through that hearing. Danny?
The difference is that the baseball game actually did have a winner. In this case, don't overlook the fact that the Republicans had a reason to do all this sitting around all day until 3:30 and not doing anything because if you look at the actual list of bills, some of them are fairly partisan bills and some of them, for example, Gonzalez's bill that would allow people to sue their guardian ad litem is one of the bills that was killed in there. So you have to wonder whether there wasn't anything a little bit more shrewd going on than just sitting on their hands and
but I will add, they can do that anyway.
Yeah, of course they can, but they had a convenient excuse where she looks terrible. Yeah. I personally was offended that she spelled waste as in waste time, W-A-I-S-T, but that's the editor in me, and I'm sorry.
That's the last word on this call.
Well, look, the copy editing of that email goes far beyond a misspelling of waste. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think I'd – I think there's an argument for throwing her off the committee. To tell you the truth, if you don't do things, if you let the most obstreperous, out-of-control kid decide whether or not the class learns anything today, that kid is in control of the class. And so what happened this time was that Minnie Gonzalez, who is behaving irresponsibly, controlled the process that day. And somehow or other, somebody needs to get back in the saddle. Somebody else needs to be in charge of whether or not business gets done. It can't be Minnie Gonzalez. She has demonstrated that.
Real quick, Senator Len Fasano, the Republican leader in the Senate, actually has worked with Minnie on this issue. And they had a heart-to-heart Friday, which resulted in Representative Gonzalez actually voting for Chase Rogers' confirmation. So there is a little bit of adult bipartisan conversation that does occur at the General Assembly.
Really? That's
I thought I'd just throw that out.
That's surprising to me, frankly. Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, is here. Colin McEnroe and Dan Haar. And we're talking through the week's news on The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Well, speaking of business at the Capitol, 2 years ago, the lottery game Keno was controversially implemented by the state legislature at the last moment. We didn't really know how it happened. Then last year, Keno was repealed. This year, Keno is back on the table. A public hearing today is scheduled on a bill that was very similar to the previous one. I don't know. Paz, I'll have you start because Danny's taking a sip of his tea. Keno's back again? We're going to balance the budget with Keno?
No, we're not going to balance the budget with Keno. It is, as my dear friend Keith Faniff would say, it's rounding error what it raises. But it is an effort to give the lottery another marketing tool in Massachusetts. There is like silly money spent on Keno. In other states, not so much. The projections last time, I think it was $17 million. Which, given where we are in deficit land, that's really not going to help
us.
It's
pocket change.
Well, they're talking about all the way to $27 million.
Yeah,
here.
Well,
now
okay.
Don't you know this again in the category of convenient excuses? If you do Keno, then you have a convenient reason to allow Mohegan Sun and Foxwoods to open one or more casinos in the Northern Corridor. What they ought to do is just give a few slot machines to Bobby Valentine and be done with it. And, you know, a few people will be able to stop.
This is the
seriously.
Off-track betting parlor that's
right, yes.
Just outside the
yes,
airport in Windsor Locks.
Windsor
yeah.
Locks.
He's not talking about Bobby's bar in Stamford.
Bobby, give him at both bars.
There we go.
And you're not going to raise any more. We need to stop talking about these as revenue bills. What we're talking about is what we want to be able to do is you know, maintain a few jobs. It's going to fail, but that's what it's about.
Keno's going to create jobs?
Keno creates the ability to have – it's all connected to the slot machines, right? They want more slot machines.
Yes.
Right? Mohegan Sun and Foxwoods think incorrectly that they're going to be able to save jobs by stopping people from going out of state, right? The reality is that MGM Grand, which is opening the rival $800 million casino, is going to hire a significant number of Connecticut residents, and we should stop playing this shell game of state versus state because it's a non – the economy doesn't care about the – Suffield Agawam border. It doesn't, you know. So it's part of a sort of a bigger ruse.
Well, and this is one of the things, Colin. When we had the conversation, including the two tribal chiefs coming in here, they talked about preserving jobs, and we have on this program argued about that and whether or not building new casinos quickly to head off people at the pass before they get to Springfield and the new casino, whether or not that will save even one job here. But Keno, I'm not exactly sure how it computes. It doesn't seem to work into the jobs category, and in terms of raw numbers, it doesn't seem to work into the making lots of money for the state. Where does it fit?
You know, you might need another low-wage job in order to support your losses on Keno. I mean, just to be clear, I mean, the state lottery corporation would run the Keno, you know, with some private contractor. That's who gets Keno. But, I mean, look, just to be talking about this is kind of an admission of moral failure. I mean, if they see it anyway, I mean, I don't understand anything that's been said about why we need Keno. But if they're talking about it as a revenue stream, which I think down the road, that's ultimately what they think is it's going to make some money for the state. I mean, it really is. That's the point at which you say we don't really have the courage to talk about taxation progressively, to talk about, in fact, high income people bearing a larger burden. We are going to grab this money out of the pockets of the people who can least afford it, people low income people going into some bar or restaurant and there's a Keno machine very close to where they're eating or drinking and they're going to lose a lot of money. And I just think that there's a moral failure. Every time this comes up, it's a moral failure.
Paz?
I think we lost that war a long time ago. You know, Connecticut is neck deep in gambling on the lottery. The lottery now produces more money for the state of Connecticut than the two casinos do with their share of slots. There is this booming business in scratch tickets. It, you know, per capita, it's a couple hundred dollars a person in Connecticut. And I think the four of us around this table, none of us are probably playing. So that means somebody out there is buying $1,000 in scratch tickets a year to make up for our failure in that regard.
But there's a difference between marijuana and crack. And everybody who's ever looked at Keno, all the people, the outside, the scholarly studies, the behavioral analysis of Keno say that it really is an especially pernicious style of gambling. It's where you go if your run-of-the-mill state-sponsored gambling isn't enough.
Yeah, I mean scratch – there's some data on scratch tickets as well. It's an impulse thing. I will admit, my view of Keno changed when I finally realized that there are certain bars and restaurants in Massachusetts that I have been frequenting for years that had Keno, and I never noticed it.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you say that war, that battle has been lost.
Well, we're hooked. We're hooked on gambling.
Yeah, I understand
revenue.
We're hooked, yeah. but it doesn't mean that you have to take the next step.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm simply saying that when we cast it in moral terms, I think we gave up the right to sort of – not the right, but we gave up that argument a while ago. And now we're talking about what makes sense financially and what's the social cost for these – I hesitate to say incremental changes, but I mean that's what we're doing.
I just want to say, and how do we decide what the last step is, Dan? I think that's the thing is where do we decide we draw the line and how much gambling in a state is too much? In my introduction at the top of the hour, I talked about Nevada. I mean it's a state that's built on gambling. You wouldn't have – a state there in the middle of the desert, if not for Las Vegas and what they grew out of it. Connecticut is never going to become that, but there is a sense that every single time we talk about the possibility of a game like this, there is something changing about what we value, what we think is going to be the way forward for the state versus something else we could be investing.
I'm with Colin on this. I think there is a bright line when it comes to putting the – it's a tax on the poor is what it is. It's a voluntary tax on the poor, and that's who pays it. We all know that. And it's April 15th, and there are protests about $15 an hour versus $12 worth of, versus $9.16 an hour today of all days. And so these are the very people that are playing Keno. When you bring the machine to the people versus saying where you can come to us and play a scratch game – that, and I know a scratch game is in every convenience store. I get that. But it's still a difference when you bring it to them.
And every Keno plays too, you know. But yeah.
Colin,
yeah.
Last thought for
you. Yeah, no, Danny's got – that's my point too. It's the blinking, worrying, alluring game that you didn't know you were even going to encounter when you walked into Chuck E. Cheese with your family that day.
We're talking with Colin McEnroe, Dan Haar of the Hartford Courant, Mark Pazniokas of the Connecticut Mirror. When we come back, the power of the librarian wielded at the state capitol. It's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, it's Wednesday, The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're joined by Dan Haar, who's a columnist for the Hartford Courant, Mark Pazniokas, who covers the Capitol for the Connecticut Mirror, and our own Colin McEnroe. What's on your show today, Colin?
Well, David Edelstein, who's the film critic for Fresh Air, as well as CBS Sunday Morning and New York Magazine. He's been on my show lots of times. We're very old friends. But we never really had a conversation about just being a film critic. What's it like to be a film critic? Go to the screenings with your other film critic friends or enemies. So we had a conversation in front of a live audience last week at Watkinson School. You'll hear that conversation today.
Ah, and it should be a fun conversation indeed. It's 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show here on WNPR. Early this week, librarians gathered at the state capitol, and the keynote speaker at this event was Governor Dan Malloy. He took a question from the audience and was asked about cuts to some small programs, including the Connecticard program that allows patrons to borrow books from any public library in the state.
You know, I understand that there are charges if the books to be delivered by a library van or to be delivered by UPS or some other. I mean, I understand that there's a cost associated with that. But at some point, we lose the elasticity of budget making to what are other constraints, spending caps, revenue. But I hear you. I do. I honestly do. And I can assure you, as somebody who's had a long personal relationship with libraries, none of this is done easily.
Now, according to testimony from the state librarian, the cost of the program last year was $950,000. I was actually part of a panel just before that. It was sponsored by the Aspen Institute, brought together librarians from around the state. And we were talking about some of these issues. And Colin, one of the things we talked about is how the state libraries can work hand in hand with whether it's the community colleges or the state legislature, anybody who's trying to make policy for the state so that the libraries can help fit in with some of the other things the state is trying to do, our goals and aspirations. One of the things that we just hear all about at the Capitol is we've got to save money by consolidating. We've got to save money by regionalizing. And through programs like this, fairly cheap programs, the library system did that like 30 years ago. And they're saying, why are you coming after us with our little tiny budget?
Well, yeah, I couldn't say it better than you just said. But yeah, so that's the thing they did, right? They kind of cut through some of these town borders and did something in a centralized way. Now the centralized thing's getting zeroed out. The other thing I would say is if you're going to pick a fight with somebody, and obviously with this budget, you have to pick a fight with everybody. I mean, everybody's getting screwed in this budget, except maybe Aer Lingus. If you have to pick a fight with somebody, try not to pick a fight with librarians. They are, first of all, unbelievably fearless. They were not afraid of the Bush administration and national security letters. They're not afraid of anybody, and they're very articulate. They know how to spell waste in their emails. Yeah, and so like you read their communications, and you know it's not just the interlibrary loan stuff. And I mean, a lot of things are being zeroed out. And one thing that I would point out, they're saying that their computer access program, the funding for that is zeroed out too. That's one of the sort of, you know, one of the real victims in the current budget is sort of upward mobility for people who are at the bottom rung of society. So, you know, whether you cripple upward mobility at the community college level or here, this is a program that I think familiarizes people with computers, people who would not otherwise be familiar with how to use computers. There's a whole bunch of programs. It's not just the interlibrary stuff that are getting zeroed out here. And yeah, I mean, he's right. I like what he says. I hear you. I'm not going to do anything, but I hear you. But I mean, everybody's suffering, but the librarians are going to fight harder than a lot of groups.
The Appropriations Committee, I think, does hear them. And don't be surprised to see a lot of this stuff either partially or fully restored. They're relatively speaking, it's small dollars with big impact. These are the things that are classic add-backs for legislators because people can absorb what these things mean. You know, there was another cut, $83,000 to totally defund something called CRIS, which is a radio program for the blind.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, it's $83,000, and that's the total state contribution to, you know, this vital service for the blind. Colin's right when it comes to, you know, don't screw with the librarians. They tend to marshal their facts. It's the humanities in general that's there. But the bigger problem is you end up in this false debate about, well, are we going to do books or are we going to pay for food for for orphans and widows?
But here's the other thing, too. I think one of the things the librarians are saying, Dan, in the cases that they're making is it's not just about books. It's not the humanities. Libraries are the places where people are getting job training these days. It's the places where they're learning how to write resumes. It's the place where they're preparing for this, you know, 21st century workforce, whatever the heck that is.
Well, I think you have to give the governor a little bit of credit, first of all, for showing up on Monday. He could have canceled.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, there he goes into the
and taking questions from the audience, which I did not expect.
Firestorm of the card catalog.
Although if he didn't visit groups that he's screwing, he'd be housebound.
Well, that's true as well. Now, if we take Keno and institute it and dedicate the revenues to libraries, humanities councils, and a few other very small things, will that make it more palatable, or is that still Keno, or is it because the theme here, we have a shell game, and so the shell game is the bigger picture is that we're not addressing the budget just as Mark said, we're not addressing the budget by taking a little bit of money out of things that really, even economically, you could make an argument that even beyond the direct job assistance, libraries are a big part of economic development because nobody wants to live in a place where there's no library, even if they never set foot there. It's just like going to the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. You don't want them drilling there, but guess what? You're never going there. So it's part of what we have in our civilization. The broader, bigger picture here is we have an unsustainable public budget life. We can't make it work.
I don't want them drilling for oil at Hartford Public Library. I just wish to state that for the record.
Well, I thought what Dan
Matt
just
Poland
said.
Will object.
Fracking's okay.
I thought what Dan just said, though, is he wants Keno in public libraries. That's actually what I heard from his statement,
yes.
Colin.
Yeah, well, once again, I mean, you know, we're all talking about false choices here. So that's a false choice, too. We'll fund the libraries, but you have to let us have Keno. No, there's a structural problem with the budget. And the structural problems they're big problems. They have big answers. And as Paz is saying, nibbling away like a bunch of ducks at all these little tiny programs is failing to really come to grips with what the problem is.
And I'm actually working on a story right now about how we're not having that debate that the governor I interviewed the governor the other day, and you know, he's starting to use this language about structural changes, about finding the new normal. You know, we're in this period of adjustment, but you don't see a major policy speech, you know, a challenge to the legislature about we have to have a serious discussion about which of these cuts are structural, and therefore if they're structural, that means you have an obligation to tell the public, don't plan on the state to take care of your disabled kid beyond the age of 18 or 21. You know, it's those kinds of things, which, you know, nobody ever wants to have that debate because it's once you start having that debate, it goes to pretty ugly places.
You
pretty
have a few seconds left, Dan.
Yeah, what we're doing is making a mistake that a small business is a different type of business. We're budgeting $60 million a year in bonded money to give to small businesses, and we're taking money away from small businesses that happen to lend books, have computers for people to use, and have small museums in towns.
That's Dan Haar. He's a columnist for the Hartford Current. Mark Pazniokas is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Our own Colin McEnroe is here as well. We're going to take a break. When we come back, more news in the wheelhouse. Right now, some of our colleagues are going to tell you how you can support all this good stuff that you hear on WNPR. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, we'll follow up on some more reaction from around the state to Governor Malloy's proposed Transit Corridor Development Authority. Spurring development around transit is the overall goal, but how should we get there? We'll have a conversation about that. We'll also check in with our friend Susan Campbell, who's sharing the story with us of a local homeless man named Sal and some of the challenges of ending homelessness in our region. Hope you can join our conversation tomorrow where we live. Today it's the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're joined by Colin McEnroe of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Dan Haar, who's a columnist for the Hartford Current, and Mark Pazniokas, who's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. And Paz, you covered this week a planned nursing home strike that was postponed after Governor Malloy stepped in. What happened?
The governor, who is extremely close politically with New England Health Care Workers District 1199, he has marched on picket lines with them at least twice before. He asked them to just cool it for a little bit. The fate of this strike is going to be tied to the budget. And nursing homes are largely supported by state reimbursements. The reimbursement rates have been flat for a number of years. The nursing homes therefore turn around and say, look, guys, we cannot afford to raise your salaries, give you better health care unless the state of Connecticut changes the reimbursement rates. So this is a holding action. I don't know where Malloy is going to intend to take it because this isn't, you know, offering yourself as a mediator to work out things between two private parties. The state, in effect, is at the table on this because the budget that they finally adopt will, I think, ultimately decide if these guys go out on strike or not.
And we're talking about 3,500 workers at some 27 facilities in about 20 towns, Dan.
Well, you know, the difference between this and a sort of a traditional labor cooling off period of the sort that we saw a generation ago at UAW in Michigan, for example, when the president would say, no, hold off, is there would always be a settlement in those cases. And here, 1199 has a long history of doing what it says it's going to do, and they will strike. You know, they'll have a strike. It may be a short strike or a long strike, but they're going to strike. There's not an easy way to have a settlement, not only because of the Medicaid issue that Mark mentioned, but also because of the structural wages in that industry, which are, again, not sustainable.
I want to move on to another story here as we move quickly through the wheelhouse today. Back in November, of course, problems with voting in Hartford created a mess, resulting in the extension of voting hours. President Barack Obama even called the Colin McEnroe Show because things were so messed up. In response, the city council attended to remove the registrar of voters, and yesterday a state court judge ruled that that can't happen. Here's Corey Brinson, attorney for Republican registrar Sheila Hall, speaking outside the courthouse after that decision.
What happened on Election Day is something that will be sorted out, but it should be left to the voters to decide what happens to the registrars, and it's not something that the city council had the authority or the power to do.
Okay, so Collins, what happens next in all this? Obviously, as a state, we sort of need to look at this. Hartford was trying to do something different. What do you think happens?
Well, actually, just for amusement's sake, let's take a trip back in time to two election days before. That would be 2013. Now, in November of 2013, one of those whopping 5% Hartford turnouts, it might have been a little bit bigger than 5%, but you know, this incredibly low turnout, the one ballot question that they actually dealt with was the registrars. And they did, in fact, vote in favor of changing this to a nonpartisan appointed position. In typical fashion, the requisite explanatory information that's supposed to be there for the voting check questions wasn't there. The registrars made all kinds of excuses and complained that somebody else was supposed to give it to them, and they didn't get it, and they were tired of people pointing fingers at them, asking them to do their jobs. Then this ballot question, having been approved by the voters, a smidgen of the voters, but the voters, a year later in November, to the best of my knowledge, nobody had done anything. In other words, the voters had voted in favor of changing the way in which this office is set up. I don't think the council had ever even acted on this. So then it turned into a much bigger emergency on election day when the ballots weren't there. Now what you've got is a court saying, well, actually, in your charter, you don't really have a way of getting rid of people, you know, that you don't want to have anymore, that you have to assume that they'll be cooperative like Eddie Perez and get indicted. But other than that, you don't have like a really good way of getting rid of people. So that may go to an appellate court. But I think you're right that somehow or other the state does have to look at this as a larger question. It's a big Hartford problem, but maybe it's not just a Hartford problem. On the other hand, I wouldn't be surprised with – I think other towns are going to say, well, don't make us the victim of Hartford's problem. We like our system.
One of the victims of that Judiciary Committee meltdown indirectly was a bill to give local option to allow cities and towns to decide if they want to have one nonpartisan registrar instead of having, you know, a Democrat, a Republican, and in Hartford's case, a third one, working families registrar.
Yeah. So very quickly before I go to – I mean – Is the state capitol going to take this? I mean, Denise Merrill talked about this. I mean, do we see lawmakers actually digging in and saying, okay, this is what happened last time. We got a huge 2016 election and a presidential election. We're going to have, you know, 7% turnout in Hartford for that. That's a joke. But, I mean, we have to really address this problem between now and 2016.
The problem is they balance how much political grief they get for something versus the public good. And in this case, they just see a lot of well-organized registrars. And in some of these towns, these are local institutions, they're beloved figures. So it's a mixed bag. And, you know, it's not for nothing that Denise Merrill didn't raise this issue until she was safely reelected, because it tends to make certain elements of the party regulars a little crazy. So I wouldn't look for any profiles and courage from the legislature on this one.
Well, I mean, even non-controversial bills take 3 or 4 years to sort of bubble up. The first year is the idea. The second year is a draft. And the third year it
not
gets a
the
vote.
Idea, not the idea of a new casino in
well, no,
Windsor.
That's right, because that's a revenue bill. But I agree with Denise Merrill in this one. This system harkens back to a time when people living in a community affiliated themselves in a deep way with a party. And that isn't the case anymore. You don't need partisan registrars. It's silly. And somebody needs to say this is just stupid. It's that people living in a community
somebody
don't affiliate
I'll
themselves.
It.
They don't say, I feel that it's the British-style Labour Party cradle to grave. We don't have that. We never really had it.
And the biggest block of voters, it should be said, are unaffiliated
voters. Yes. Unaffiliated.
So let's have the unaffiliated registrar. Let's get my people in.
But even the 38% who are Democrat registered, 99% of them don't really consider themselves to be affiliated in the sense that they need their own registrar.
And other states do this with professional, right. Nonpartisan people. I think Connecticut is the only state that has precisely this system.
So we're back to what Pat said, which is that the legislature is at that tipping point between what's the right thing to do for the public good and what will it get too much grief for. Guess which one's going to win out. And that's sad.
Tomorrow evening, the New Britain Rockcats will play their final opening day game in New Britain Stadium. The team, as you may have heard, will become the Hartford Yard Goats next year. So the team is going to move, but the city of New Britain, Dan, they want to keep a team. They want to get a team there. This is what you were writing about.
Yes,
this week.
That's right. Mayor Erin Stewart had been waiting until March 1st when she received the letter, which was due that day, an answer from the Rockcats, nay Yard Goats, who as to whether they were going to exercise a 5-year extension that they had. And so when it appeared likely, we'll see, but likely that a stadium will in fact be built in Hartford, for better or worse, in April of 2016. They gave her the letter and she was free to negotiate, and she is talking with a number of professional baseball leagues, the most promising of which in terms of creating a real sort of replicating what they have now is the Atlantic League, which has the Bridgeport Bluefish, the Long Island Ducks, a team in Sugar Land, Texas – It's eight teams now in a league that's 18 years old, and they more or less are on the level of AA. There's an argument in baseball, and it's irrelevant to the fans. If that were to happen, and a lot has to happen for that to become the case, there would be Hartford Market, which is big enough and rich enough to support two minor league teams competing against each other, and that would certainly hurt the Yard Goats in Hartford, but it may create a lot of excitement in the margin.
And just so people understand what the Atlantic League is, a double-A baseball team that would be affiliated with, say, the Colorado Rockies, as the Hartford Yard Goats would be, is essentially playing 20, 21-year-olds who were recently drafted, who are prospects in their minor league system. The Atlantic League has guys like Jose Canseco. It has managers like Pete Rose. It has Ricky Henderson. It has guys who are 47 years old who haven't played in the major leagues for 10 years.
Yeah, actually, so the advantage for those players, about 40% of the Atlantic League rosters on those eight teams are former major leaguers trying to get back. And the rest of them are high-level players who were signed to organization contracts but were cut. The advantage for them is they're in a league where they can be put on a team in any of the major leagues, not just the one that they're playing for. And so it's a good system. It complements minor league baseball affiliated.
It's a free agent development league.
It's exactly what it is.
But showcase.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Which makes it fun.
Which makes it fun, which could make it a lot of fun. And I guess the question is, for the city of New Britain, they feel stung by their team fleeing to Hartford, taking this money and becoming the Yard Goats. I mean, is this potentially a good thing for New Britain?
Well, you know, that baseball park in New Britain, it's not in an area where you go, you walk somewhere afterwards. You know, they might get some other business. But it is a little different than what they're at least trying to do in Hartford, which is the idea of a downtown park where there's allegedly some spillover, hopefully some spillover, pick your adjective. So I don't know what kind of a blow this is to the larger New Britain economy. The big thing is they have a stadium that's paid for. It's in good shape. It's a pleasant place to go, you know, watch a game. So why not? If you've got a league there that's looking to come into a new market, go for it.
Collins
is kind of a sunk cost at this point, right? I mean, I think from New Britain's point of view, why not do it? They don't have any reason to feel charitable or nice towards Hartford, and they've got this stadium that otherwise is just going to have cobwebs growing across it. Sure, why wouldn't they do it?
Now, I did talk to the founder of the Atlantic League about this, and they're really the ones pulling the strings. They're not going to go into a situation where it's us versus them. They don't want a competition against the Yard Goats. They want to see a market where they can both thrive. Nobody wants this is going to become a theme here. Nobody wants to fight a Yard Goat.
Well, look, we just have a few minutes left, and on this theme, you know, we saw, and I don't think we've had you in since the fast track, the Connecticut fast track opened, and I know we've had conversations about this for a while. It's the sense whether it's us fighting against Massachusetts for casino jobs or casino dollars, or Hartford fighting against New Britain. It seems as though we're dealing in these kind of micro economies in which we think it's somehow going to matter. We're going to build a baseball stadium, then you are. All these things are 17 miles away. I mean, I know it's probably asking too much to have big picture economic thinking, but there's an awful lot of money seemingly being spent on replicating services and fighting over just tiny little bits of territory. Why do we keep doing this?
Well, if we have two baseball teams, maybe we can get actually competing cable systems and then have really something going.
I mean, Colin, this is really the issue. The fact is we just don't have the need to have two baseball teams within a couple miles of each other. We don't have need to have Hartford and Springfield beating each other over the head, do we?
No, although, I mean, the other way to look at this is you can sort of look at it as kind of a critical mass issue, too, that if you have a lot of stuff going on, you have a lot of stuff going on. This is geographically a very small area. Hartford's a tiny little place. I mean, New Britain would be part of Hartford in a lot of parts of the country. So, you know, if you have a lot of stuff going on and a lot of choices and a busway connecting two geographic locations, you know, maybe that's not such a horrible thing. I understand what you're saying, fighting small fights over a very small battlefield, but maybe this is okay.
Well, and that's – I mean at the state level, Paz, we talked earlier around the library system about towns and cities maybe being incentivized to work more closely together. I mean is there a sense at the Capitol that people really are starting to think – I mean maybe not, as our friend Tom Kahn would say, you know, really talking about regionalization, really talking about, you know, something that looks closer to county government, but – Is anybody really thinking substantively about making decisions in a different way than we've been making them over all these years?
The House Speaker, Brennan Sharkey, is a big believer in regionalization. So you do have that. But most of it, I think, is under the radar. You do have this fiber optic network that's been developed actually is literally and figuratively knitting towns together. So you have small communities that have realized they can band together for very expensive information technology services. So instead of having an old server and an old janitor's closet in town hall, which is what you would literally have in some of these towns, you now can have it offsite, taking full advantage of the cloud, taking advantage of a modern information superhighway. So some of this stuff is happening. It's also happening in less sexy ways on regional health districts, things like that, but not the big, big picture stuff so far.
The big picture is the tax, the property tax, and that's what Speaker Sharkey is trying to get at. Unfortunately, that's so much more politically unpalatable than any question of registrars that we're not even in the same decade with that issue.
As we go, I'll just say our producer Tucker Ives has a really great idea here, a yearly busway series between Hartford and New Britain. It would be an exhibition series, and it'd actually play it, and the teams would go back and forth on the busway between the two parks. I like this idea very much.
Would that be between innings to go back?
Maybe in between innings.
That's
one
how fast
inning
it is.
At
seven
each park.
Minutes, seven
it
minutes.
Is indeed the CT Fast Track. Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. Dan Haar, columnist for the Hartford Current. Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse on Where We Live.